Support for Here and Now comes from BetterHelp, committed to supporting mental health through therapy. Clients are matched with one of 25,000 therapists and can communicate via video, chat, or phone at betterhelp.com/public.
From NPR and WBUR, I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. It's Here and Now. As some European countries take steps to reopen their economies, the president of this country says he wants to open at least parts of the U.S. by May 1st.
And judging by plans from the state of California, the CDC, and FEMA, that seems ambitious. For instance, countries in Asia and Europe have cell phone and contact tracing, tracking down every person an infected person had contact with to isolate them and allow healthy people out. Dr. Yovan Maldonado is an epidemiologist at Stanford Medicine. Dr. Maldonado, you've said maybe open by July and with much better tracking, but what about reopening some less infected states sooner?
Yeah, actually, that's probably the best way to, I think about where we would start. So one thing we would need to do, I think, is to make sure we understand what the infection rates look like across a wide variety of regions, and where are there hotspots in those areas that can be tested and maybe mitigated. And then in the other areas where the prevalence is lower, then we could probably start with some staged introductions, et cetera, staggered work times that we think would be helpful in slowly getting the economy moving.
Well, it would seem that, though, that testing is so critical here because South Dakota thought it was pretty coronavirus free. And then suddenly there's 300 workers at one of the largest food processing plants in the country testing positive, free to travel around the state because there's no stay at home statewide. So is that kind of risky, assuming that a state doesn't have any outbreaks?
Well, I think that is the fundamental epidemiologic principles that organizations like the CDC really take in mind. And that is, surveillance is critical. And by surveillance, I mean you have to look for cases. You can't just expect them to show up, especially when we think so many people are asymptomatic. So you need to go out and test people. If you don't test, you really don't know what's going on, and you might think you have no problems.
Right. And what about the notion in the CDC FEMA plan, at least as outlined in a draft that the Washington Post obtained, of slowly opening schools and daycares, again, to help their parents get back to work? But that reminds us that there's all the adult daycare workers and teachers who will be going back to the schools. Your thoughts on that?
Yeah, so that's actually, again, a reasonable approach, but it needs to be done systematically. For example, what you'd want to do is figure out if you can get ready access to rapid testing for people coming back into the workforce. Now, one of the limits of that approach is that you can assume that somebody who's tested negative today is only negative today. So what you would want to do is bring people in, make sure they're tested, and use masking during that period of time if they're asymptomatic. Obviously, if people have symptoms, you wouldn't bring them back to work right away.
Well, the CDC is, to be more specific, is calling to reopen community settings where children are cared for. That's K through 12 schools, daycares, summer camps. But what precautions would you recommend for those facilities? I mean, are we talking about contact sports for kids? How would you like to see it?
Well, it's hard. It's going to be different for each region and for the size of the daycares. I would probably start with places where you have the lowest density. For example, summer camps, maybe, where you could have the kids spaced out and not doing contact sports right up front. But again, strongly considering testing everybody who's coming into that environment. And the tests that are available can be done rapidly. They need to be very accurate tests because there's a lot of tests out there, and some of them give you false negative results. So you'd have to be careful about that as well.
Dr. Yovan Maldonado, epidemiologist, infectious disease specialist at Stanford Medicine. Dr. Maldonado, thank you.
Thanks so much.
Well, the Treasury Department says more than 80 million Americans will get their relief checks this week, one-time payments of $1,200 per person. And many of those people will be restaurant workers whose entire industry has been essentially frozen. In Seattle, a new charitable organization called the Plate Fund is offering additional $500 payments to restaurant workers who have lost jobs or income during the pandemic. It was founded by groups including the Schultz Family Foundation, as in Howard Schultz, the former CEO of Starbucks, who joins us now. Howard Schultz, welcome. And why did you decide to do this, and why focus on restaurant workers?
Well, thank you. I think we're all experiencing the issues surrounding the pandemic of the coronavirus, but there's also another pandemic, and it's the economic fracturing of small businesses across the country, and specifically the manifestation of that is the millions of people who are now unemployed to no fault of their own. In Seattle, over 3,000 restaurants have closed. Approximately 100,000 hardworking Americans are unemployed. They haven't had a paycheck for 3 weeks. Government assistance has still not arrived. And we just felt we have to do something. And so we created a very innovative platform in which $500, which would be a cash bridge until assistance came. But I'm deeply, deeply concerned about the fracturing of the economy as a result of small businesses, that many of whom, probably 30-40%, will not open in this country. The restaurant industry is one of the largest employers in the United States, and I think we have to do everything we possibly can to see if these businesses can stay open and provide a humanitarian understanding that is very humane and very sensitive to the fact that people are in desperate situations. And from what I can see and understand, the government assistance program has really been designed for big business and not small businesses. When I hear the politicians talking about the small businesses are the economic engine of the American economy, that's true. But the current assistance program does not demonstrate that.
Well, why do you say that? Because the president would say that small businesses are meant to be able to have loans, which can even become grants if they keep their employees on the payroll. Obviously, there's unemployment insurance going out to a lot of people, including extended unemployment benefits. Right now, you still think that's not going to be enough?
Well, not only is it not being enough, but as of today, about 90% of the federal assistance money has already been spent. And if you speak to most small businesses in the country, they have either not qualified, the red tape, the bureaucracy, they're not going to get the assistance. The time to solve this problem is now, not 2 to 3 months from now, when the situation is much different. But in the meantime, the Plate Fund has been designed to give people a bridge. We've raised $6 million. We will help at least 12,000 individual people. 55,000 people have already come to the site. We've processed over 7,000 applications, which demonstrates the desperation. And I just think the government should do two things that I think would solve this problem. The first is, not unlike the UK and Denmark, America should provide at least 80% of the employees' salary during this period in which they're being fired or furloughed. In addition to that, there's no reason why the government couldn't act as a backstop for the banks and provide a bridge loan with very low financing for every small business and restaurant in America that will not be able to reopen. This would be the kind of government assistance that we should be applying to this problem, not creating a situation in which big business benefits and the banks can do what they want to serve their core customers and not take the situation into hand and help those businesses who can't help themselves.
We've been talking to economists who worry that income inequality is only going to get worse around the world because of this crisis. Howard Schultz, what kind of responsibility do you feel as one of the world's richest people to make sure that doesn't happen?
Well, first of all, I completely agree with the economists that the crisis of capitalism over this last decade has added to the inequality issue that exists in America, especially when President Trump went ahead and gave that corporate tax cut, which had no bearing on the economy and didn't address inequality. I think we all have a responsibility. And I think if businesses and government and philanthropists and nonprofits could come together and not use the coronavirus as an opportunity, I would never say anything like that, but take advantage of this situation by taking a step back and reframe the corporate responsibility that businesses should have and then look at the government's opportunity for once and for all to do this in a way that would be the most humane situation and address the inequality issue, which is only going to be enhanced significantly in a very desperate situation by the fallout and manifestation of the coronavirus in the months to come.
The company that you used to run, Starbucks, is open for drive-through and delivery in the U.S. and Canada and requiring workers to wear face masks. Do you think that's the right approach, or is the safest option just to close stores?
Well, we've done two things. First off, Starbucks is paying all its employees during the coronavirus, and so that there's no issue whatsoever with employees who have been fired, terminated, or furloughed. We have not done that. Secondarily, we've taken the most strict safety and health precautions for our people and our customers and provided a drive-through service for our customers. We think that's the right thing to do at this point as people are looking for Starbucks coffee to be open. And we're just trying to do everything we can to, in a sense, exceed the expectations of the customer during this very difficult time and protect our people.
I want to ask you one more thing. You explored an independent run for president, but decided not to run because you didn't want to risk reelecting President Trump. Have you endorsed Joe Biden for president yet, or would you like to do so?
I'm speaking to the Biden people. Joe Biden is a very good friend of mine over the years, and certainly I'm going to be enthusiastic for his campaign and hope that he becomes the next president of the United States.
That is Howard Schultz, the former CEO of Starbucks, whose Schultz Family Foundation has partnered with other groups to create something called the Plate Fund, offering $500 payments to restaurant workers in the Seattle area who have lost jobs during the pandemic or income. Howard Schultz, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you. I appreciate it. Thank you.
This message comes from Here and Now sponsor, Indeed. When it comes to hiring, you don't have time to waste. You need help getting to your short list of qualified candidates fast. That's why you need Indeed.com. Post a job in minutes, set up screener questions, then zero in on qualified candidates using an intuitive online dashboard. And when you need to hire fast, accelerate your results with sponsored jobs. New users can try for free at Indeed.com/here now. Terms, conditions, and quality standards apply. Offer valid through March 31st, 2020.
Reporting has revealed the president's slow response to the coronavirus in the U.S. The president is blaming the World Health Organization, the agency of the U.N., and punishing them with this announcement yesterday.
Today I'm instructing my administration to halt funding of the World Health Organization while a review is conducted to assess the World Health Organization's role in severely mismanaging and covering up the spread of the coronavirus.
Well, today, House Speaker Nancy Pelosi called Trump's move illegal, says it will be challenged. Let's bring in Ali Velshi, MSNBC anchor and economics correspondent. And Ali, you know, most people acknowledge the WHO did make missteps, but while Trump says they willingly took China's assurances at face value, he praised China at the same time when the U.S. was negotiating a deal. Remind us.
Yeah, January 24th, actually, about a month after the virus was first discovered in China, Robin, Donald Trump tweeted, China's been working very hard to contain the coronavirus, and the U.S. greatly appreciates their efforts and transparency. Now, there's three pieces of context to this whole World Health Organization thing. One is, it's a bit of a distraction, right? This comes as there's a lot of criticism on the White House for being slow to react. Number two, there is an antipathy in this administration for all of these international organizations, whether it's NATO or the UN or the World Food Organization or any of them. The third issue is that the United States tends to be the biggest shareholder, if you will, in any of these organizations like the World Bank or the IMF or the UN. And it's the same situation with the World Health Organization. The Gates Foundation is the second biggest, but China is a big donor to these groups as well. And as China becomes more influential, these donor organizations do tend to listen to the influence of their large donor companies. So that's part of the nature of the question. I think the reality lies somewhere in between, and that is that it's worth looking at the World Health Organization structure and efficiency, but right now this concept of passing the blame on to the World Health Organization may not be well-founded.
Well, but passing the buck, because there's also tape of President Trump praising China at the time the WHO was, as we know now how many people were telling him otherwise. But let's go to the effect. You mentioned the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, the second largest funder of the WHO. Bill Gates tweeted today, halting funding for the World Health Organization during a world health crisis is as dangerous as it sounds. What impact will it have?
So the World Health Organization has tried to raise money to help fight coronavirus, but fundamentally, its main job is to alert countries and get them to do the right thing. So when we couldn't get guidance from the federal government in the United States, we were looking to the World Health Organization for guidance about how this disease spreads. It's very important, and it's uniquely important in poorer countries, which are predominantly in the Southern Hemisphere, in which it is summer right now. So they haven't been hit yet, and they spend a lot less money. So what Bill Gates, who works a lot in Sub-Saharan Africa, for instance, is concerned about is that this thing is going to be a tidal wave over other economies. In terms of the developed world where coronavirus is right now, it's probably not that impactful. This is probably more political than anything else. But in terms of what the rest of the world is going to experience with coronavirus until there is a vaccine, which is probably a year away, Bill Gates could be right. This could be very, very serious.
Quick question. Is Nancy Pelosi right? Is this illegal for the president to say he can pull funds? Just briefly.
We're still looking into that. That's interesting. They're claiming that it's the same violation of the same law that the president violated when he froze the money, the aid to Ukraine, which was specifically congressionally approved. This is a little less clear. It is congressionally approved money, but it's not clear that it fits under the same law. The White House is saying that they've got broad scope when it comes to interpreting how money that's appropriated is exactly distributed. So that we're still looking into.
So we'll check back with you. Ali Velshi, MSNBC anchor and economics correspondent. Thank you.
My pleasure, Robin.
Well, let's turn now to our political strategist for their take on President Trump's handling of the coronavirus crisis. Alice Stewart, Republican, and Bill Press, a Democrat. Welcome to both of you. We haven't heard from either of you since this crisis started, in part because there's just so much other than politics to cover right now. But let's talk about what just happened and what we just heard Ali talking about. Alice, why would the president pause funding for the WHO during a global pandemic?
Hi, Jeremy. Great to be with you. It's important to do what he's doing for several reasons. It's critical to get to the origin of the WHO's response. And as Ali said, there was slow response out of the gate from the WHO. When China gave them information, this was all the way back in November and December. The WHO took their word for that, praised them for their response to it, and we now know that the information out of China was not accurate. And Ali was right. There are some large stakeholders in the WHO, the U.S. being the top contributor to this organization over the last few years, $893 million. There's a great graphic on the NPR website that shows the U.S. contributions to WHO, but China is way down the list, $76 million over the last 2 years compared to our.
But is now the time to remedy that?
We need to get the answers. We can use the money that we are giving to WHO and put them directly into the hands of the federal workers and small businesses that actually do need them. And he is not, the president is not saying this is a complete stop in the future, but until we get some answers, this is the right thing to do.
Bill.
Jeremy, let me just weigh in here. Look, this is the last time to be dickering about who gives how much money to what and when do they give it and where does it go. Come on. We have a global pandemic that needs to be addressed, and the number one priority has got to be stopping the spread of this, taking care of the people who are suffering, and, you know, make some steps in the future, be sure it doesn't happen again. This, to me, is classic Donald Trump on two fronts. Number one, anything that has any touch of global cooperation, he's against, right? He sort of thinks we're on this island of ourselves, whether it's NATO or the Paris agreements or the UN itself, and now the WHO, right? WHO. He's got to be against it too. It's Donald Trump playing the blame game again. I mean, I think Americans are getting sick and tired of the blame game. Donald Trump has blamed. You could pull the quotes. He has blamed Barack Obama. He's blamed the media. He's blamed Europe. He's blamed China. Now he's blaming the WHO. And I would invite anybody, if you want to play the blame game, go back and look at all the times that urgently and repeatedly Donald Trump was warned by members of his own administration that there was this coming pandemic and we had to take it seriously. And he did absolutely nothing. So I think it's dangerous to play the blame game for him.
In addition to that, with regard to WHO, the president, he came right out of the gate and imposed travel restrictions with China, and the WHO criticized those actions, and they were the right actions to take. And so there's a multifaceted reason why the president is taking this step, but it does need to be investigated, and the president has made the right steps with regard to responding to China.
Well, I hate to jump in again, but I do have to point out that the travel ban was very limited. It was limited to American non-American citizens. There were 300,000 people came here from China the month before, and according to the New York Times, 40 to 100,000 who came here after Donald Trump's travel ban. The horse was already out of the barn.
Okay, guys, just bear with me here because I'm working from home, so there's already a delay on my line, and then we've got the delays on both of yours. But let me ask you this, Bill. Do you think it is wrong for House Speaker Nancy Pelosi and the Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell to keep the Congress in recess right now in the middle of this crisis? Shouldn't there's obviously risks of having lawmakers together, but isn't there a way for them to do it and keep focusing on the issues that are very important right now to the American people?
You know, that's a tough question. You know, when everybody else is social distancing, it would be impossible, really, to do, I believe, on the Hill, the kind of social distancing that would require to have the both the House and the Senate there, their staffs there, and to be working in those quarters. At the same time, I don't think they should be on total break. I think it's imperative, and I can't believe they haven't already done this, that the House and the Senate haven't figured out how they can have active debates on Zoom or whatever and vote without having to come back to Washington for that. So I think that's maybe a higher priority. Yeah, get back to work. But it doesn't mean, like those of us working from home, that they got to go into the office and risk getting the disease or spreading it.
Alice, when you look at Trump's relationship with the governors, he's gone after the governor of Washington State, called him a snake. He's said bad things about the Democratic governor of Illinois. Do you think that he is playing favorites with certain governors like Ron DeSantis in Florida at the expense of other governors?
I truly think, Jeremy, this is a time to put politics aside and focus on the pandemic. And there have been instances where that has not been the case. There needs to be a seamless flow of information between the federal, state, and local officials. I do think that the governors bear a tremendous responsibility, and a lot of the burden of responding to this is on their shoulders. I will say this, for the president to say he has the ultimate authority to reopen the government, I happen to say I take issue with that. The president may say he has the authority to reopen the government. However, the Constitution says something different. And it's important for these governors to have the full faith and support of the federal government in order for them to do what they need to do. And at the same time, all governors from every state, Republican and Democrat, do need to rely on the help of the federal government. And it needs to be there across the board without party partisanship.
All right, we're going to have to leave it very quickly, Bill. Yes.
Yeah, just very quickly. I want to salute the governors of this country, Republican and Democrat, for stepping up to the plate and showing the leadership that they have.
Bill Press and Alice Stewart, I'm glad you're both safe and healthy. Thanks so much for joining us.
Stay safe, Jeremy.
With the disclosure that Zoom is a financial supporter of NPR, we have been hearing a lot about Zoom bombing. You're on a video conference call on the popular app when a gatecrasher posts offensive videos or images. It's a problem, especially for groups that have to make their meetings public. NPR's Shannon Bond has the story.
Camp Hill is a cozy little community of 7,500 people near Harrisburg, Pennsylvania. Pretty much everyone knows each other. But like many places across the country, Camp Hill is on lockdown. So last week, the president of its borough council, Lee Twyford, held an online town hall on Zoom.
We just wanted to get the word out to our residents that we're here, we're open. You know, the doors are locked, but we're still working. Here are phone numbers that you can call if you need help. You know, if you're looking to volunteer, here's how you can do that. It was kind of just a way to communicate with our borough because we haven't been able to.
But things went off the rails.
I was reading a report and I looked up at my screen from the report I was reading and there was porn on the screen.
Camp Hill was Zoom bombed. Twyford tried to kick the intruders out.
What happened was as I tried to push people out of the meeting, they would figure out legitimate names of people that, you know, were really residents of our town. And so they'd sign back in under that name. So I didn't know who was a real person and who wasn't a real person.
Twyford had planned to take questions at the end of the town hall. Instead, she shut it down. Her experience isn't unique. Zoom has become really popular because it's so easy to use. School classes, AA meetings, and religious gatherings have moved onto Zoom, and so have harassers. That's creating a particular problem for public officials who are trying to keep important services running and their citizens informed during this crisis. Susan Bisewitz is Lieutenant Governor of Connecticut.
And I just can't tell you how frustrating it's been to try to talk to people about how they apply for unemployment benefits or small business assistance and have all of this other extraneous stuff going on.
Stuff like racist, sexist, and homophobic comments. Zoom says it condemns these attacks. It's changed the default settings, so people need a password to join a meeting, and new participants are kept in a virtual waiting room until the host lets them in. Hosts can also turn off screen sharing, so other participants can't hijack the meeting. But those who need to hold public meetings are struggling to figure out how to let people participate without becoming targets. Sunshine laws in many states say local governments have to make meetings public and open for comment, like Michigan's Open Meetings Act.
We honor every piece of that Open Meetings Act in terms of we do not get together without announcing it in advance and discuss how we're going to vote on things. That is meant to be done in the light of day.
David Anderson is the mayor of Kalamazoo. A city commission meeting there was Zoom bombed in March. Of course, offline public forums can also be disrupted. But Anderson says there's more accountability when people have to stand up and give their names. He's concerned about any online platform where people can be anonymous. Now he's working with the city attorney to figure out how to hold public meetings while keeping online trolls away.
Can we, for example, collect recorded messages in advance and then see whether appropriate to play or not? Does it really have to be live in real time?
He hopes to have an answer before Kalamazoo's next meeting later this month. Shannon Bond, NPR News, San Francisco.
And we want to take a closer look now at that new study published in the journal Science from a team of researchers at Harvard University's Chan School of Public Health, with the attention-getting headline that some social distancing may be needed through 2022 to keep coronavirus in check. Helen Branswell, with our partners at STAT, the Health and Medicine publication, has been credited with being one of the earliest and best sources for news about the coronavirus pandemic in the U.S., so we turn to her. And Helen, to the study, basically, they're saying the idea of one-time distancing, you know, like we're doing now, is not going to stop the pandemic.
Right. What effectively they've looked at is, you know, how effective this would be at bringing transmission down to the point where, you know, going forward. And they say that it's unlikely that enough people have been infected already that you could get anywhere close to what is called herd immunity, enough people in the community who already have some immunity to it because they've been infected. And, you know, if you get to the point where you had herd immunity, you would expect transmission to really start to decline. But what they're saying is, you know, we're not there yet. And if you release the social distancing measures, what's likely going to happen is you're going to have a resurgence of cases, right. And you're probably going to have to effectively do this on an intermittent basis, you know,
for a long time,
months and maybe longer.
Well, yeah. And you speak of immunity. They also remind us there's different kinds of immunity, you know, whether it's short term or long term immunity is going to be a consideration, whether the common cold, which we've been reminded is also a coronavirus, may also give people some immunity, but that might give a false impression because that would be in the short-term category and COVID-19 could then come roaring back. So immunity has different levels.
Yeah, that's right. There is some question about whether or not if you have some immunity to those viruses, whether that would give you what is called cross-protection. Mm-hmm. So some kind of a boost that might protect you against the SARS-CoV-2 virus, which causes COVID-19. But again, these are factors that just We won't know until we've been living with this virus for a little while longer.
Known unknowns. Well, there's also another factor. Enough intensive care beds could figure in. How so?
Well, what they're saying is, you know, if the goal is to keep down transmission so that your hospital system doesn't get overwhelmed, if you increase your capacity to treat severely ill people, then you could let up on some of the community distancing measures that are in place, because then you could safely treat people. If we get to the point where a therapy that is known to be effective and prevent people from transitioning from sort of an early mild infection to becoming very severe, if you got something that could work in that kind of a setting, then also you could start to loosen up, because you wouldn't be as worried about the healthcare system being overloaded.
Yeah. Warm weather, you know, they say is not going to kill it. And we know that. We're seeing it in places and countries that are very warm, but it could reduce it. And again, that gives sort of a false sense, doesn't it?
One of the concerns is that, you know, if it sort of dies down a little bit in the summer and everybody starts easing up on measures to slow transmission, that effectively you could be pushing another peak of infections into the fall and winter, when the virus is expected to be able to transmit more efficiently. You know, most respiratory viruses do. And, you know, that would be a time during which we'll also be dealing with influenza, so which puts a lot of burden on the healthcare system. So having a 1-2 punch in the winter would be really not great.
Yeah. Helen Branswell, with our partners at STAT, the Health and Medicine publication, will link you to her writing at herenow.org. Helen, thank you.
Thank you, Robin.
Well, today, New York's Governor Andrew Cuomo says this will all be over when there's a vaccine. But as we wait for a vaccine and nasal swabs and antibody tests or any other solutions remain scarce, one group of researchers is developing a diagnostic test that anyone could download on their phone. It works by listening to the sound of your cough. Scientists say they can distinguish the sound of a COVID-19 cough in patients exhibiting symptoms. Lara Orlandich is working on the project. She's a research assistant at the Swiss Federal Institute of Technology. Welcome.
Thank you for having me.
So this is something that scientists have used to diagnose whooping cough, asthma, pneumonia in the past. How does it work?
Yes, so it uses cough signal processing and machine learning to basically listen to the sound of the cough, use some math algorithms to determine what kind of frequencies the cough is made up of, and then you feed that into machine learning algorithms, and they determine whether the cough sounds more like coronavirus or pneumonia or other sorts of pathologies that we've seen before.
Well, the World Health Organization has said that 2/3 of COVID-19 patients exhibit a dry cough as opposed to the typical wet cough that you get from a cold or allergies. You sent us some recordings that people submitted to your research team. First, here's a wet cough. And here's the dry cough that people are experiencing with many COVID-19 cases. Okay, that definitely sounds dry there. That person actually reportedly tested positive for COVID-19. Is there a chance, though, using the sound, that you could either miss a case or give people false positives?
Yes, definitely. That's always the problem with the sort of automatic screening method. But we've seen with the nasal swab test as well, there's some reports coming out that there are some false positives, false negatives as well. And our system can never be 100% perfect because, as you know, there's that 1/3 of patients who are asymptomatic, so they don't show any cough symptoms at all. But what this app can do is it can serve as a sort of preliminary screening tool to first maybe put people at ease in case they're at home wondering whether or not they have coronavirus. And then another feature of our application is that we ask users who submit a cough whether it's okay to save their GPS location. So then perhaps in the future we can provide local governments with information about, this is how many people in this area have a cough that sounds like coronavirus. You might want to check on this.
Right now, what is the state of this project? People cannot yet download an app, but you are soliciting more recordings of coughs.
Exactly, yes. So we have a website set up. So right now we need a lot more data because in the traditional experiment setting, you would have a couple hundred people come in. They would use the same recording software, recording hardware as well. And it would be in the same sort of quiet environment. But this isn't the case with the study. You have people with all sorts of different devices from around the world and different, perhaps some noisy, some quiet environment sending in the recordings. So the moral of the story is we need lots of data to be able to train the algorithms to distinguish between the types of coughs, despite all the additional noise. Yeah, we have the website set up that people can go to and donate their coughs, both people with coronavirus and without, but we just need lots more data right now.
The one question I would also have is, because you mentioned you might share this information with local governments, do people have to consent to giving their location and having the results of the test be shared with third parties in order to use this app?
Yeah, so when you upload a cough sound to our website, you are asked whether or not it's okay to share your location. But the app is completely anonymous, and we don't share any personal information like your name, age, any personal identifiers. So it just uploads your cough, a couple of questions we ask you, and the location.
Well, I have to say that as somebody who works in the audio medium, I would be really happy if the use of sound helped us deal with the coronavirus. That would be nice.
Definitely, yes. It would be very exciting. And this has been done before. Like I said, it's a huge telemedicine initiative in third world countries to be able to use a simple mobile app where in places where people can't go to a doctor regularly and can't would have to travel long distances to be seen by a specialist. So hopefully we can leverage the sort of technology to provide more universal testing in coronavirus affected areas.
That is Lara Orlandich, who's a research assistant at the Swiss Federal Institute of Technology. Thank you so much and good luck with this.
Yeah, thank you so much. Thank you for having me.
And we will link you to the website Lara talked about where you can record the sound of your cough, if you have one, at hereandnow.org.
Many stores are low on cleaning materials, TP, but what if you are desperate for diapers? Diapers and some infant formulas were some of the first things hoarded when the outbreak came. Now diaper banks, which help low-income families, are struggling to fill the need. Joanne Goldblum is the CEO of the nonprofit National Diaper Bank, a loose association of places across the country. Joanne, how bad is this?
So it really is tough. You know, basically, the COVID-19 pandemic is disproportionately impacting children and families, particularly those who lack access to clean diapers and other basic needs. And, you know, hoarding and then loss of jobs and shelter in place have forced more and more families to turn to nonprofit diaper banks, depleting the already low supplies.
Yeah. Give us a sense. I mean, do you have numbers?
I can give you what we've heard from our members, which is every diaper bank in our network has seen an increase, an exponential increase in the number of people asking them for diapers. And it ranges. You know, we hear for some, it's about 50%. I spoke to a diaper bank yesterday who was telling me that they saw a 300% increase.
To be clear, you know, people might be saying, but isn't there aid for low-income people or, you know, people struggling with resources in a time of unemployment? But the Special Supplemental Nutrition Program for Women, Infants, and Children, it's commonly called WIC, those benefits don't cover diapers. Diapers are lumped in with pet food, cigarettes, and alcohol.
Yeah.
Welfare, you know, people on welfare, they get a very tiny amount of money. It's not enough. You know, diapers can cost an average of $18 a week per child, almost $1,000 a year. We know we're hearing stories of, as I said, women watching other women load cars with packs of diapers while they can't afford to buy extra. Are you hearing directly from parents?
Yes, we're getting lots and lots of requests. And it's quite heartbreaking because even before COVID-19, we recently had an article in the American Journal of Public Health. It talked about the fact that diaper need is a public health issue. We see such an extreme need. The fact is that about 40% of Americans before this didn't have $500 in the bank for an emergency. And so if you extrapolate that, you know that that means there are so many people who can't manage a week or two without income. So really, the poorest among us are always the hardest hit. And we're seeing it expand so much now to so many people who had never considered themselves to be living on the edge.
Yeah. By the way, we should also mention it's not just diapers, it's formula and prescription formula. So tell us some of the things that diaper banks are doing, some of the things we can do. Can you send sealed packages of diapers if you can get your hands on them? Can you send them to diaper banks?
The thing, you know, that is most helpful right now for both the National Diaper Bank Network and for our member programs is cash donations, because we are able to buy extremely large quantities at a much lower price.
And by the way, maybe that's the safest.
Right. Certainly, if people ordered online and sent them directly to diaper banks, many diaper bank programs have wish lists on Amazon or Walmart, you know, on one of those platforms. But the best thing is direct cash donations. So certainly people can donate to the National Diaper Bank Network, but also we have a listing of all of our member programs. So if people would like to donate locally, they can go through that list and find the diaper bank in their community.
Well, and by the way, people might be saying, well, what about cloth diapers? But people are making their own cloth diapers.
Right. Many of our diaper banks distribute cloth diapers and do cloth diaper education. And many diaper banks during this time are expanding that. One of the issues with cloth diapers for many people is that if you're working and your child's going to daycare, it's a very difficult thing to do. We are, as a diaper bank movement, encouraging people during this time, if they're able, to consider cloth, especially because diapers are harder to find right now. And there is a lot of information about how to sew your own.
Yes, there is a video. So we'll link people to your video about making your own diapers. Something we hadn't thought of that we should be thinking about anyway, it sounds like, Joanne. People need
Absolutely.
Diapers.
The truth is that prior to COVID-19, one in three American moms has struggled with this issue. Now it's even bigger. And we are seeing a great response from companies. The other way that people can help is, you know, for companies that produce product. For example, we are distributing books from Penguin Books, we're distributing breast pumps from Even Flow Feeding, you know, things like that that people might need during this time for families. We're very happy to get those products out to people who need them.
Oh, fabulous. Joanne Goldblum, CEO of the nonprofit National Diaper Banks Network, thank you so much. We'll link people up to everything. Best of luck to you.
Thank you so much. Have a great day.
Well, and Jeremy, I've learned today that I'm going to donate my cough off of your story and diapers.
You know, it does feel good to help out when you have the ability to do so. We'll link to both of those at hereandnow.org.
Yeah. And Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. This is Here and Now.